Welcome to Raiders of the Lost Podcast, one of the fastest growing movie podcasts in the world, where we discuss all things film. In this episode, we discuss Fargo and The Big Lebowski. Hello, hello, movie friends. Welcome back to the show. This is Anthony.
And this is James. We're going to do some Coen Brothers films. We're going to do Fargo and The Big Lebowski. We have really only talked about No Country for Old Men, I think, for the Coen Brothers. And
yeah, we've touched on these a little bit, but not much.
I mean, they're some of our favorite filmmakers. We love all of their movies. They have like a diverse range of genres that they tap into. They can do comedy. They can do drama. They can even do a little action. They do a little espionage and Burn After Reading. So their films are so... they're versatile filmmakers. You know, they can do anything. They have hardcore beloved fans all over the world. Some of their films are cult classics, like Lebowski is definitely.
These two are.
Yeah, Fargo, I think, is just a better movie all around, but I think Lebowski is really damn good. I think it's more of a cult status than Fargo, if you know what I mean.
I mean, I'm not sure which one I like better. It's hard to pick. I really like Lebowski.
I think, for me, I like Fargo better. I think it's a better movie, but I think Lebowski is way funnier.
I think, yeah.
They're both very funny, but Lebowski's hilarious.
You could say Lebowski is much more entertaining, although Fargo is hysterical.
Yeah.
But I just think, like, because Lebowski has the music and it has, like, you know, just Jeff Bridges and John Goodman are just amazing together. So I think that it is a little more entertaining.
For sure.
And it's more ridiculous and a little bit more creative with the filmmaking.
Yeah, I mean, Fargo is just more, the setting of it being so mundane in Minnesota and in North Dakota. No offense if you're from those places. It's just the small towns they're in.
Well, that's the whole point.
The mundaneness, yeah. It makes it seem like a different world on a different planet sometimes, which is like, it's less entertaining but more interesting, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, because... what the Coen brothers have always done, going back to their first film, Blood Simple, which is really excellent. If anyone hasn't seen their first film, it's really amazing.
That's also what Frances McDormand got well known for.
Her first movie. Yeah. It has one of the most amazing final acts I've ever seen. It's just insane. Check it out. It's on Criterion Channel right now, or you can rent it. What the Coens have always done is casting locals. So in every kind of Coen brother movie, you'll see, maybe except for Burn After Reading, you will see local actors. And they do this purposely because they want you to feel like you're in that world. You're in that city, you're in that small town, like especially with Fargo and Lebowski, especially Fargo more than any other movie of theirs. And No Country for Old Men, they did it really well too. It isn't Lebowski too, but not too much. But casting locals makes you feel like these people live there, so it makes you feel like you are there. And it's super beneficial to the Coen brothers for adding that authenticity because they like to set their movies in situation in environments that are atypical for usual Hollywood block films. You know, they're not like Lebowski's in L.A., but it doesn't feel like an L.A. movie. You know what I mean? And Fargo, obviously, in Minnesota, you've never seen a movie set in that world. And, you know, having this crazy, ridiculous, complex murder mystery failed kidnapping plot set in the middle of Minnesota is just so fun.
In North Dakota.
Yeah.
And before we continue, the best way to support Raiders of the Lost Podcast is to become a patron at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast. We'll get awesome perks like our podcast schedule, personalized videos, Patreon shoutouts on the show once a month, as well as access to our weekly bonus episodes, which post every single Wednesday. We also just launched our podcast masterclass online course. So for anyone who wants to start a podcast or want to improve their current podcast, our 22 chapter 46 video lesson course will give you all of our secrets from behind the scenes of our show. The link is podcastmasterclass.teachable.com, or just go on our website, raidersofthelostpodcast.com. You can find it there. Use coupon code podcast10 to get 10% off right now. Follow, subscribe wherever you're listening. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to hit that notification bell. And thank you so much for tuning in around the world. And so casting, I think, is one of the greatest strengths for the Coen brothers as filmmakers. And they kind of remind me of Tarantino, Paul Thomas Anderson, directors like that, where they're excellent at casting their actors for characters. And they also work with actors for multiple projects at a time, or over and over again.
Yeah, John Goodman's worked with them a bunch of times.
And Frances McDormand's been in 7 of the Coen brothers' films.
Wow, that's a lot.
Technically,
yeah.
Joel, because he's the only one doing Macbeth. So yeah, that's the 7th one she's been a part of.
And even though Joel is the solely credited director in the first few of their movies, they technically did direct their first few movies together.
True, but so that's an interesting topic to start on, I think. So when Joel and Ethan Coen make their films together, they actually also edit everything as well. They use the pseudonym Roderick James so as not to highlight their names too much, too many times in their films. But as the, even though they work as a team, like you just said, their standard credit sequence is for Joel to be their director, and then Ethan takes on a producer credit, and they both usually share their writing credit for all their films.
But in their that's for the first half of their films. Now they both get shared directing credit. And what happens is the Academy doesn't – the Directors Guild wouldn't allow them both to get credited as director for their first few films because they have a bunch of weird rules. And one of the weird rules is in order to be credited as a duo, you have to have a longstanding history of working together as a collaboration. This is why Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard weren't allowed to be nominated for the Dark Knight score they made because they had never – they didn't have a longstanding filmography together. They just did Batman Begins. So that's why they weren't allowed to get nominated. Like, not allowed. And so Joel's credited in the first, I think, four or five movies, maybe even more. But then the last, like, 20 years, it's been directed by Joel and Ethan Coen. Mm-hmm.
And so also Trisha Cook serves as a co-editor on several of their films, not all of them. She's actually married to Ethan Coen. And then we all know that Frances McDormand is married to Joel Coen. So they tend to fall in love with people you work with.
Just like Chris Nolan and Zack Snyder.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Zack Snyder's wife, Deborah Snyder, produces all of his films. Yeah.
And then Emma Thomas is Christopher Nolan's wife.
Yeah, but I love the Coen brothers in their films because they're not complicated. They just want to tell you an interesting story with all their films. And I love like the concept of Fargo being like the irony of it being not real events, but they say it's based on real events. It's like a bunch of real crimes that they just pulled up from the world that they heard about and like put into a story about kidnapping and ransom and stuff like that. So it's not, even though they open it with like, this is a completely real story, that's a joke.
Yeah, they did that as a joke, and it's great because it's not just this is based on real events. It's like, out of respect for those who lost their lives, we're not going to use anyone's real names. It's so funny.
I actually have a little info on that. So according to Robert Taylor at Collider, the Coens did cherry pick a few details from real life included in the movie. The wood chipper bit was inspired by a real-life murder that occurred in Connecticut about a decade before Fargo was released. A man named Richard Crafts was arrested and found guilty of killing his wife and using a wood chipper to dispose of her body.
Oh,
so we all remember the scene in Fargo.
What are you
going to
do with the cleanup?
And Joel Coen told Huffington Post that Macy's character was loosely inspired by a real General Motors employee, so William H. Macy's character, Jerry, who attempted to defraud the company by gumming up the serial numbers for some of their automobiles, a scam similar to the one in the film, hence Jerry is involved with before he moves into the kidnapping.
So it's like a really dumb plan.
Yeah.
Because the paper trail is going to lead back to him.
Yeah, so that's the thing with Jerry. I love that character so much. But so Fargo was released in 1996. This has a 94% score on Rotten Tomatoes, 92 audience score, top rated movie on IMDb at number 176. It has 7 Oscar nominations, including 2 wins. This is what Frances McDormand won her first Oscar for.
First of three.
Yeah, and then also it won screenplay, best screenplay. And then The Big Lebowski came out in 1999, has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 83% critic score. Wow.
83?
And then 93% audience score, top rated movie at number 208. And just to refresh everybody's memory, and that's on IMDb, Fargo follows a Minnesota car salesman, Jerry Lundegaard, and his inept crime falls apart due to his henchmen bungling and the persistent police work of pregnant Sheriff Marge Gunderson after he creates a plot to kidnap his wife in order to get the ransom from him for himself. And then Bill Lebowski, quick little synopsis, the ultimate L.A. slacker, Jeff the Dude Lebowski, mistaken for a millionaire of the same name, seeks restitution for a rug ruined by debt collectors, enlisting his bowling buddies for help while trying to find the millionaire's missing wife. And I love both these films, and I think they go so well together as like a double feature.
Yeah.
Because even though they have similar plots, kind of, they're both about kidnapping and ransom, even though maybe one of the movies they're
both about fake kidnappings.
Yeah, the kidnapping's not real, and they're both about greed. And it's this trope, this cliche story that we've seen on TV 100 times. We've seen it in 100 movies about a kidnapping, a ransom plot. We have cops, we have criminals. But the Coens, both the stories, even though they're kidnapping movies, they are both so incredibly unique and fun and interesting.
Yeah, and they also have, they repeat scenes like in No Country for Old Men, Blood Simple, a few other of their films. Like, for example, in Fargo, when he's trying to drag the dead body off the freeway before anyone shows up. Same thing happens in Blood Simple, remember?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, there's the black case of money. They actually use the exact same case that's in Fargo that black case is the identical one to the one they use in No Country for Old Men, but that carries the money that Llewellyn Ellen finds.
Oh, with the tracker in it?
Exactly the same exact case. They did that as a reference.
That's so cool.
An Easter egg to Fargo. Also, like, Peter Stormare plays the sadistic killer who just ends up killing everyone, just like Anton Chigurh. Lead characters in over their head. And then, obviously, a kidnapping plot. So the Coen brothers, they stick to similar kinds of storytelling devices. But like you said, they approach them in unique ways every time, whereas No Country for Old Men is just a straight dark thriller. It has a little few moments of levity, but otherwise it's a very grim movie. Whereas Lebowski, it's hysterical and laugh out loud funny at times.
Yeah.
So their approach is changing, even though the devices are pretty similar.
Yeah, and the Coen brothers, what's so great about them, they've achieved a status as filmmakers that it's pretty rare to get, where your directing name, the Coen brothers, that supersedes any of their casts, especially even if you look at, like, Hail Caesar, that cast is absurd.
Yeah.
Burn After Reading, absurd cast. But no one goes to see that movie because of these amazing actors, and they go to see it because it's a Coen brothers movie, which is insane. I love that. It's like Nolan, Tarantino, a lot of these directors. And Fargo and Big Lebowski, where the tones are pretty different, although they have their own kind of world aesthetic that they build. You know, they build that with these super interesting characters that we'd never seen before. The realism, like you said, with having locals who are in the side character roles, like in Fargo, I think the two sex workers are like the best example of, like, these two women are definitely from either Minnesota or North Dakota. Like, that accent sounds natural for sure.
Frances McDormand actually based her accent off of one of those women. And she spoke with that woman for days, recorded her, and researched and really dug into her accent and basically imitated her for the character of Marge.
Yeah, and she kills, like, the Midwest nicety. She is good in that movie.
That smiling, that always being super nice, even when she's in an unpleasant situation, she still puts on a smile that's kind of just, like, more of a defense mechanism than anything.
Yeah, but the Coens, I think they're on that level of similar to Kubrick, where they create their own tone in world. You know, it's pretty rare to do that for a filmmaker, and I think that they pull it off in every one of their movies, because when you put on a Coen Brothers movie, it just feels like a Coen Brothers movie immediately, especially a movie like Fargo, where, like, you're inside, like, these bars and everything, and they make it just feel like such a real world, but also these wildly interesting, unique characters really just bring it to life even more.
I would say that they're the best at the genre of dark comedy. I can't think of another set of filmmakers or filmmaker that is better at that darkly comedic tone that they managed to capture. And I think it's a combination of how well crafted the movies are, how funny they can be, how ridiculous the characters are. And the Coens oftentimes put their characters in realistically dangerous situations and in really dramatic situations. So that kind of balances out the comedy and the humor, where one scene you're cracking up and the next scene you feel like someone's going to die. And I don't think any other directors or writers really pull that off the way that the Coen brothers do.
Their movies have so much personality.
Yeah.
And it's because of the characters they create. Like, I love Lebowski because I think it needs a few viewings for people to really understand what they're doing. And I think it takes a couple to realize that the entire film really is a parody, in a way, of these tropes in Hollywood, of these kidnapping movies, these stories. Whereas Fargo isn't so much like that. Fargo has, like, a little more of a serious tone despite the characters. But Lebowski is so much of a parody. And the more you watch it, the more times you watch it, you see more and more things that allude to that, obviously. And I think my favorite example of it being a parody, obviously, the character of the dude who's, like, in this situation, he's, like, the laziest person in Los Angeles, in the world, maybe. That's what the God character, the stranger character, talks about. And he's, like, involved in this crazy plot of a kidnapping and ransom. And it's like, there's no way watching this, like, there's no way this guy's going to succeed at whatever he does. But you still root for him the whole time. So he's the exact opposite of what you expect from a hero of a film.
Well, that's the same thing with Fargo, too, with Marge's character. You don't expect this very sweet, kind, loving pregnant woman, to be investigating these grisly murders. You know, we're used to, like, these strong, tough cops and cool detectives investigating these, wearing sunglasses.
With, like, a dark past.
Exactly. Yeah, they're alcoholics and they're never clean shaven. And so I think that juxtaposing this sweet, kind lady in the situations is the same thing as putting the dude in this other situation, where these two characters who you would never expect to be in these stories are leading the stories.
Yeah, Marge is a great example to talk about first because this is, the role that Frances won her first Oscar for. Marge doesn't get introduced into Fargo for about, 30-plus minutes of the film?
Yeah.
But once she arrives, she steals the entire movie from that point on. She nails that Minnesota Midwest nice. The accent, it's so good. But she brings so much warmth and relatable elements to Marge to make her feel like this real person, this real character. And I love that the Coen brothers make her 7 months pregnant, or like I think it's her. She's obviously in the third trimester. Yeah. And so it's great that you're talking about why make Marge so incredibly sweet and so nice and at such a late stage pregnancy. And I think it's because, first of all, it's unique and interesting. We don't see stuff like that, even though it's part of real life. Pregnant women work all the time, but we never see that in movies. You know, sometimes it won't be too much of a pregnancy, but it'll be like a little bump and people are working in a film. But to have a pregnant woman be the sheriff of a town, we've never really seen that before. And so I think they also did this to Marge so that the characters in the film and the audience, you know, when you watch this movie, you underestimate Marge first impression, just like you underestimate Dude because of his laziness and laissez-faire attitude. But then we immediately see Marge, how sharp she is when she's at that crime scene for the first time. She's analyzing it with ease, and she's still 7 months pregnant. And the pregnancy, you would think it'd be like a weight on her shoulders, you know what I mean, even though it literally is a weight on her torso. But it doesn't slow her down at all. And she's sharp, and she solves the crime literally on her own, arrests Greer and everything by herself.
I'm going to have to disagree on your police work there.
She's so funny and sweet.
Yeah, I love it. And I was going to say something.
It's okay. I keep going. Marge, she's just that refreshing counter to all the cliche cops we see in movies and TVs, whether it be a female or male officer, detective, sheriff. They all seem to be cut from the same cloth, just copied from characters of the past. Marge is the exact opposite of what we'd expect from a sheriff. That's what makes it more realistic. That's what makes the character so much more interesting.
So in terms of how she's introduced, I really like it when filmmakers, they wait until the character needs to be introduced to introduce them. I think so many other filmmakers and writers, you would have seen Marge before that, before the investigation of that homicide on the freeway, and you would have maybe seen like A Day in the Life or her at the office or her and Norm.
Because it starts as like Jerry's movie.
Exactly. And I think it works better this way. You can say the same thing as like, I mean, Chris Nolan will do it sometimes where it's cool to, you don't have to show the character until they need to be seen by the audience. And she's irrelevant to the story until the killing. So there's no need to show her and Norm until that moment.
Great point.
I think it's great when writers are like, okay, we have this lead of the movie, famous actor, but they're not necessary until this moment happens 30 minutes in. And so we're going to wait to show them until that moment happens. And I think that is a really smart way of approaching the character.
Yeah, and then so Marge is so great, but it opens up really as Jerry's like first act of the film, because I love Fargo. Within 4 minutes, we know kind of the plot of the movie. Jerry Lundegaard is paying these two guys to kidnap his wife so that he can collect a ransom. So Jerry Lundegaard, played by William H. Macy, I think it's his best role, super funny. Really great character, possibly the worst person in the film, even compared to Greer, who's a murderer, because he's a constant scam artist. He's not a very good one either. He's a complete idiot. He's a liar. And he just tries to swindle every person in every situation. So he even tries to swindle the robbers, the kidnappers himself. He tries to swindle Carl and Greer because they think the ransom's just going to be for $80,000, but really he's asking for $1 million, so he wants to keep all the money for himself.
And even his clients, like the guy who's buying the car with the coat, what does he call that coat?
Oh, some of the tea.
Yeah, the true code or something.
True code, yeah.
Yeah, and he's like, I never asked for it. We said 19.5. We agreed on 19.5.
You're a liar. You're a liar. That's what you are. Give me my checkbook. Let's get this over with.
Ethan Coen said that he actually wrote that verbatim from a real scene he had with a car salesman who did the same thing to him.
Wait, so a real life situation?
Yeah, he said it was verbatim what happened with him and his wife when they bought a car.
Yeah, so Jerry's just a horrible, horrible person. He just wants money at all costs. But greed is a main theme in both of these films. So for greed, in Fargo, the character, so Carl, played by Steve Buscemi, will do anything to get more cash in his life, tries to take advantage of Jerry earlier on in the film, just not a very good person. Gear is virtually a mute who never talks, but he seems to be floating through life with no path besides the next job or hit or whatever it is. Jerry is so desperate for cash that he scams that loan company, then hires men to kidnap his wife to receive the ransom for himself, while also taking advantage of his father-in-law and trying to take the $1 million from him, scamming the kidnappers into thinking the ransom is only $80,000. He's also asking his stepfather to invest $750,000 into a parking lot that he wants to buy, where he gets all the money and profit, and he'll just give them their money back with interest. And then Wade's like, wait, you want us to just give you all the money so you make all the profits?
He's a terrible criminal.
We're not a bank.
And William H. Macy is so good in this role because he also performs that Minnesota nice, and he's always just on the edge of panic, and he has this tone of voice, this like high-pitched fake nice tone that he's always putting off on people, even when like you could tell how visibly upset he is and how close he is to like losing his shit constantly. William H. Macy, I think this is his best role. I think he's really great in Magnolia too, and obviously his TV show, what's it called?
Shameless.
But I think that his performance in Fargo has got to be the best of his career. He's really fantastic.
He's really good in Boogie Nights too.
Yeah.
And then Wade is even very greedy, where he doesn't even want to pay the full million to get his daughter back safely. He tries to bring it down. I'm only going to bring them $500,000.
Have a mill.
So like everyone's so greedy in this film, except of course for our hero, Marge. She's like and her husband who paints the ducks.
Norm. I want to talk about
Norm.
Marge and Norm together. It's so cute.
Yeah.
Like just I love the scene when they're at that big dining hall and then the Coens just because the Coens are so good with inserting you into a world. It's not like a fantastical world, but they treat it that way. It's not like they're not like walking into Narnia. They're walking into a banquet hall in Minnesota.
Buffet.
Yeah, the buffet.
We're watching this. I'm like, we got to hit up a buffet soon. Love buffets.
Because first they do the close-ups of all the food. So it feels like this feels so real. You know what I mean? It feels like you're there with them. And everything's so accurate, I'm sure, and authentic to what it's like over there. And just they do this great wide shot, and they hold it for like 30 seconds of Marge and Norm just walking, looking for a table.
To their tables.
The camera doesn't move. It's just static. And the Coens, what they're doing is they're inserting you into this world. And stuff like that, the locals, again, the realistic locations, I'm sure that's a real banquet hall in whatever town they filmed that in. It makes you really feel like you're in Brainerd.
They do a great job in the opening of Fargo at that bar where Jerry meets Carl and Greer. So I think that's another great example of inserting you in this real-looking environment. It's just like being in the bowling alleys in Big Lebowski. It feels so authentic and real. But I want to stay on Jerry for a little bit more. So Jerry Lundegaard, why does he need all this money? And so there are two reasons. Obviously, the first one is because in December in the year 1986, the movie takes place in 1987, Jerry scammed GMAC by receiving a $320,000 loan, probably just for himself or to pay off debts, for several non-existent vehicles by submitting order forms with unreadable VINs. And the VIN is that vehicle identification number on the front of your windshield. And so that's what he's been trying to – that guy who keeps calling him on the phone because he needs the real VIN numbers. He's like, oh, yeah. And he's doing the very thick pencil to make it seem – to make it more unlegible the next time he sends it. And then he also needs the money – wants the money from his father-in-law and from the other businessman. I can't remember his name.
His partner, yeah.
To buy that parking lot. And you could say that he wants that just to become like his own
business,
successful man. You know, he doesn't want to be a car salesman anymore. He kind of wants to be seen as an equal to his father-in-law, be a success on his own. He's so desperate to just become like a successful businessman that he'll risk getting his wife killed just for that. If you're watching on YouTube or on social media, you may have noticed that Anthony and I have some brand new laptops on our desks. These are courtesy of LG, the 17-inch LG Gram ultra lightweight laptops. The cool thing about them is they're 16:10 aspect ratio, which means more vertical space, which is great for editing, great for note taking, but most importantly, so amazing for watching movies and TV shows on these incredible displays, which I'm telling you, I binged Succession in like 3 weeks. I can't wait to watch the next episode on it tonight after we finish filming. I've been dying. It's Sunday. A few days before this episode posts, and I need to watch it. I can't wait. I'm going to watch it on my LG Gram in my bedroom under my blankets because it's comfy weather now. So we'll put links in our YouTube video bio for the 16-inch and 17-inch models of the LG Gram. Thank you so much, LG, for sponsoring the show and for these amazing laptops. And it's winter now. It's getting a little chilly. So don't you know you're going to have to keep up with all that grooming, even though nobody's going to see your body in the wintertime. So I recommend getting the Lawnmower 4.0 groomer from Manscaped. Use our coupon code Raiders of the Lost at checkout. Even though their Cyber Monday and Thursday Black Friday deal is over, you can still get 20% off and free shipping from the entire site using our coupon code Raiders of the Lost at checkout. They just launched their 2-in-1 shampoo conditioner, their body wash, which I've been using religiously in the shower. Obviously, I shower every day.
I hope so.
But also, check out their 4.0 groomer. Check out their boxer briefs. They're super comfortable. T-shirts are very comfortable and soft. Their weed whacker is great. Their body wipes, everything. They have foot deodorant. You name it, they got it. They're expanding the line even more in January, so we can't wait to share those products with you guys. But we get to keep them hush-hush for now. So go to manscaped.com. It's holiday season. All you men, if you need some gifts for yourself, ladies, men, if there's a man in your life, whether it be boyfriend, spouse, fiance, brother, cousin, dad, you got to get them, well, maybe not your dad. If you got to get them something for the holidays,
yeah, get them.
Get them something from manscaped.com. Use our coupon code RaidersVelocity at checkout for 20% off and free shipping. What, I don't know, if you gave your dad like a grooming, if you're a woman and you give your dad a grooming kit, that's a little weird, but a guy, I think it's okay.
I think it's totally fine. Everyone get your dad a Manscaped groomer. Everybody.
Do it right now. Get it if it pops. And his father-in-law, Wade, treats him like he's not even part of the family. Like, he's worried about the money. He's like, oh, they'll never have to worry. But he doesn't include him in it.
It reminds me of the father in Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah.
Of Anne Hathaway's father. Mm-hmm. That same thing, treating him like he's not even really part of the family.
Yeah, it's a Jake Gyllenhaal's character.
Yeah, exactly. And I really love the accents, but the Carl, Steve Buscemi's character, he really shows you how ridiculous the accents are, because he generally does most of the dialogue in a normal American accent compared to other characters. Like, you know, Greer says a couple of words here and there, and Wade doesn't have the thickest accent, but Carl's complete lack of an accent really brings out the other accents so much.
Yeah.
Because the Coen brothers are cross-cutting the Carl scenes with the Marge scenes and with the Jerry scenes, and that really brings out how zany this accent is, how nice these people are, the Minnesota nice. I really think it's exceptional what William H. Macy and Frances McDormand did.
Yeah, because Carl clearly seems like he's from like a city somewhere, like on the East Coast probably. And then Greer seems like he's European of descent.
Swedish.
Yeah. So, and then he's German. He's a nihilist. He's a German nihilist in Lebowski.
No, they just think he's German because they're idiots.
They call him German too.
Yeah, because they're idiots.
Yeah, but they speak German.
No, they speak Swedish.
They speak Swedish?
Yeah, they're Swedish.
Oh, I was wrong.
Yeah.
Never mind. It's, well, they're okay. Nihilists,
either way. Yeah, they call them Nazis because he's an idiot.
Don't worry, Donnie. These men are cowards.
Shut the F up, Donnie. we're just trying not to swear in this one.
We'll do it. We're doing a pretty good job so far.
We're doing great. But I read that, so Norm and Marge, before they got married, and now this is something, John Carroll Lynch plays Norm. He's a great underrated actor. Like, he's the Zodiac in, the suspected Zodiac in Zodiac. You've seen him in a ton of roles, and very, very versatile actor. So the Coens weren't sure what to do for a backstory. They weren't sure if they were going to even include it. So they actually asked Frances McDormand and John Carroll Lynch to come up with the backstory of how did they get here in their marriage. And so what they came up with was that Norm and Marge used to both be on the police force. And then once Marge got pregnant, they decided one of us should be a stay-at-home parent while the other one stays a cop. And they decided that since Marge was a much better cop, Norm should stay home. And so he quit his job as a police officer, and then he started painting ducks.
I love how they introduced the ducks. It's just like a slow pan through the garage of all. Oh no, it's their bedroom of all the duck paintings and the wooden duck, the mallards. Yeah. And then they're sleeping right next to the bed.
He's trying to get the stamp.
Yeah, he gets the 3-cent stamp, not the 27-cent, 29-cent.
What's funny about them is every time you see them, they're either lying in bed or eating.
That's true. Yeah.
One of those two things at all times.
They're so cute together.
Yeah, like he brings her lunch at work, and he's like, honey, you got Arby's on me.
Hi, Norm, you got Arby's on me. Well, since we're talking about Norm and Marge, we should probably talk about Mike Yanagita and that scene that she has when she goes down to Minnesota, the Twin Cities, to interrogate the criminal who hooked up Carl and Jerry, the mechanic, and I think a lot of people might watch the scene and be like, what is the point of this scene at all? And why is this happening? Because when you watch it, it seems to not be integral to the plot. But I think that is an important scene because on the surface, it looks like it has nothing to do with the plot. But you can say that it's one of the reasons Mike calling her is one of the reasons that entices her to go to Minnesota to check out the lead in person rather than doing it on the phone. Because, you know, she's 7 months pregnant. Maybe she doesn't want to do that and all that traveling. But because Mike called her up.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah?
So, how are you?
How are you? Yeah, it's been forever. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good.
Pretty good. He does a great accent as well in this. And so I think that's one of the important reasons of the scene, to entice her down there to get further in her leads in her investigation than to start talking to Jerry, interrogating him. And then I think a lot of people are watching it. Is she planning on having an affair with Mike? I don't think so at all because, you know, she's not immune to curiosity, even though she seems to be like the most innocent person alive. Marge is just a very good person. But it definitely doesn't seem like that's what she's interested in, because as soon as Mike goes on the other side of the table, she's like, no, get away, go back on the other side of the table. Even though, you know, she did get dressed up, she didn't tell Norm about this meeting or date or whatever you want to call it. She kept it secret and never brings it up to him later on. I just think that she was just curious to see an old friend, see how they were doing, and I think it's just being polite and nice, too.
Oh, yeah, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Darn tootin'.
Don.
I think that Marge was just being a friendly person, and I read that the Coen brothers put that scene in because they wanted a scene of character development for Marge that didn't have to do with the case.
Yeah, that's the part,
or
two.
With Norm.
Yeah, so you can go on it.
And so with that scene, the way she reacts to that very uncomfortable moment, they showed she's a very strong person, and she's very, she knows what she wants and she knows what she doesn't want, and she stands up for herself.
Immediately, like, yeah. If she's in a situation, yeah, that she doesn't want to be in, she ends it.
So I think that scene is actually vital to understanding how she acts for the rest of the film, especially at the end when she finds the car driving around the lake, and then she encounters Greer. Doesn't hesitate, shoots the guy and then arrests him. It shows, and I think that scene in the restaurant shows that it's like building up to like showing she's capable of something like that.
Yeah, I think it's more, I think that, yeah, that has something to do with the two, but I think it's more about her conversations with Jerry. So the first time she gets to Minnesota, she talks to Jerry, and Jerry's at this point like boiling inside. Everything's going wrong, and his wife's kidnapped, and he's trying to keep it secret, and he set the whole thing up, and the car's missing, and he's trying to lie about it. And he does the Minnesota nice, and she falls for it. You could say maybe being so nice and such a sweet person and always seeing the best in people, you could say could be a character flaw of Marge's. Because I think when she has that date with Mike, you could say if it's a date or not, the way that he acts about being so polite and nice, but then below the surface, his real intentions were not pure. They were pretty messed up to just go on the other side of the table and put his arm around her like that. It's not a good situation that she wanted to be in at all. So I think that maybe that scene, or that going out with Mike, made her realize, you know, just because someone's being nice doesn't mean they're not hiding something. And then the second time she talks to Jerry, he's even more of a mech, more of a wreck and a mess, and then he drives away.
Yeah.
But she also starts to interrogate him in that situation. The first time she does like the very sweet interrogations, which are always so fun for her to watch her do.
It's more the first one, it seems like it's just some simple information she needs. There's no reason to suspect Jerry because she doesn't know about any kind of kidnapping. All she's investigating is the homicides and trying to figure out where this stolen car came from and why the mechanic got the phone call. So she has no reason to suspect Jerry at that time, but then he becomes much more suspicious by the second conversation.
But maybe she doesn't have the attitude going into the second meeting that she has if she doesn't meet with Mike the night before.
That's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And be like, fuck these men. Sorry for the swear.
Just bleep it out, bro.
Effing men! And then I want to talk about Steve Buscemi. I think he's really fantastic in this movie. It's one of my favorite Buscemi roles. I think it's possible it could even be better than his Reservoir Dogs one as Mr. Pink.
I think he has more dialogue and more to do in this
movie. Believe
one,
it or not,
sure.
Yeah, he might in this film. He really carries a lot of the scenes he's in because Peter Stormare is great, but he obviously doesn't have any dialogue, really. But Carl is such a funny character. He is, like, constantly, like, just trying to gain control of the situation, but he himself is, like, kind of a bumbling fool. I just really think that Buscemi knocked the comedy out of the park. He's really funny in this.
Yeah, him and Gear, it's just a funny back and forth, because that's what I love about the Coen brothers. They'll take these two hitmen, these two like kidnapping guys, criminals, and show their ridiculous journey to and from the crimes and during the crimes, rather than just being the tough guy criminals, like, oh, we're going to do this and all that. But we see all the funny moments that are probably happening with real criminals in real life, in real car rides, all these. When you're driving for 16 hours, obviously one of them is going to start losing their mind while talking and everything. So it's just so fun to see them in their back and forth.
It also shows you how much easier it is to write a story if it's set before you had before cell phones were a thing. Because if Jerry had a cell phone, he could have just called up Carl and be like, it's off, don't kidnap her, problem solved. Nothing would have happened.
Oh yeah, so let's talk about that. So Jerry obviously creates this kidnapping plot, And before it's going to go down, Wade tells him that him and his partner are interested in the deal, and it's very juicy. So Jerry thinks
it looks good. Numbers look good.
So he thinks he's going to get $750,000.
It's a sweet deal.
But then he finds out it's just a finder's fee and then he eventually loses his finder's fee because they're just going to take advantage of the deal that he found. And then obviously he can't tell Carl and Gear to not kidnap his wife, which they do, and then everything just goes wrong.
Dude, not having cell phones makes you so much more free to do whatever you want with a plot.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
So many problems can be solved or prevented with a cell phone call or with a text. And so that's why, like, I'm sure, like, filmmakers like PTA Tarantino, they always write period pieces for that very reason, I guarantee you.
Yeah, you're probably right.
You have so much more freedom and less restrictions without having modern technology.
Because when you watch a modern film and people aren't on their phones all the time, you're like, where are all the phones?
Yeah, why aren't all these 14-year-olds on their phones right now? This crazy. Doesn't make any
like,
sense.
Like, I was thinking that when we watched Ghostbusters Afterlife, when there's like 6 or 7 teenagers in the back of a pickup truck or an El Camino.
No one was taking a selfie.
No one had their phone on. I'm like, that's not realistic. Yeah,
there would be 16 selfie videos being filmed.
Love the movie, but everyone would be Instagramming a story right there.
And then Peter Stormare, he's such an underrated actor. He's so great in these Coen Brothers movies. He played my favorite version of Satan in Constantine.
Yes.
And he's also in John Wick 2 for a little bit. I think he's an awesome actor. I think for being a foreign actor, he's made a pretty successful career in Hollywood. I think he's really funny in this movie.
He has a ton of credits.
Yeah, he reminds me of Anton Chigurh in this, but like a more funny version. And then obviously he's so ridiculous in Big Lebowski, but I think that this character reminds me a lot of Anton, someone who has like a job, but like they just kill just to kill,
in a way. But Anton falsely justifies his actions, whereas Gear just kind of is an impulsive person, like where he kills Carl at the end because he just can't stand his talking anymore. He's like, I'm done. Even though he walks out the door, he gets even more cash from Carl. He kills the hell out of him with an axe, just cuz.
Same thing with Miss Lundegaard.
Yeah,
she said she was shrieking.
Oh yeah,
she was shrieking.
Not that it's funny. It's just funny.
It's supposed to be funny. Yeah, it's okay to laugh.
I don't want to get a 1-star review.
We're not. It's everyone right. laughs at it.
Sorry, I'm just trying to always be so funny. Careful. I'm gonna get canceled for saying we laughed at a movie.
You're gonna get axed. Someone's gonna show up at our doorstep and murder us
for real. Well, anyways.
There are two collaborators of the Coens that have always been with them, mostly.
Mostly.
Carter Burwell, the composer, who's done nearly every one of their films. Excellent composer. And he always brings so much to their films. And then, obviously, Roger Deakins. Roger Deakins,
the GOAT.
Roger Deakins didn't film the first few of their films, but Fargo was one of the early ones that he did film. And he really shows, like, he has so much talent. And there's some really terrific imagery that sets this movie apart from other dark comedies. This movie is perfectly shot.
Yes, the cinematography is beautiful. I think one of my favorite shots in film history in general is the parking lot.
It's a very famous shot, and there's very few DPs that would ever come up with shots like that. You know, so many other filmmakers would film that in a very simple way, but he's like, no, let's throw the camera way back there and just get the entire parking lot. And I love the sense of how they captured snow. We're from Boston, so we know what snow is like. And oftentimes, snow in movies looks super fake. Always never seems realistic. And snow hardens, you know, and it's hard to walk through. It's not just powder that you can just like kick around. Mm-hmm. You know, once it freezes, it's just solid. And so I think they did a great job of capturing snow.
That crunch under the boots.
Yeah, like when Carl falls into the snow when his face is blown open, like stuff like that. It's realistic and it makes it feel even more authentic because it feels like every time I see a movie, snow in a movie, I'm like, that looks so fake. It's not real.
Yeah, but also you notice that it never actually is snowing in Fargo, even though it's snow everywhere, which is common. I mean, it'll snow in the wintertime if you're in a cold environment, in a cold climate, in region of the country or in the world. It doesn't melt because it's so cold, so it'll just be there for months, you know, and then it'll get accumulated.
It just builds on top of each other.
More and more snow. Sometimes it melts on a sunny day, even though it's cold, but still, there's always just going to be snow around, which in movies, they always make it seem like we have to see the snow falling in order for people to realize that there's snow. There's always snow in New England the entire wintertime.
And also, they filmed this, it was unusually warm that year in the areas where they filmed, and they actually couldn't film it all in Minnesota and North Dakota.
Minnesota?
Minnesota. They had to go to other states because it was so warm there. And I think they really did a great job of capturing the freezing cold weather. When I watch this movie, I feel cold when I watch it. You know what I mean? I think they really captured it really well with the performances. Seeing the breath, you know, with getting like the character stuck in the snow, it felt so real.
It goes with the characters too, yeah. And their mess ups. Like I think with Carl Gear and Jerry's wife when they're in that cabin and the cold, you really feel like you're cold watching it. Especially the shot where the breath coming out of the bag over her head.
Yeah.
It's great.
That's
it's
the
great
best
shot
in the movie.
It's a
best
really good shot. And you just feel like everything, they're in over their heads and everything's going wrong and just wrong. And the cold is just making everything even worse for them.
That's something that like Roger Deakins manages to always capture, like these little moments. And he'll be like, I'm just going to hold the camera on this for a minute, where no other filmmaker would really hold the camera on, you know, the breath coming out of the mask. But he's someone who's like, I'm going to keep that. We're going to hold on to it for like 10 seconds. And it's really beautiful.
It shows that they actually really shot in a cold environment.
Exactly.
Like you can't really replicate that. You can't do that digitally in an effective way.
Even nowadays, it still doesn't feel real. You know what I mean?
There are some movies where they fake it with CGI. It's okay, but it's not real.
It's not the same. The breaths always look the same.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I feel that for sure. You want to move on to, you want to talk some more about Lebowski?
Do you want to get into our intermission first?
Oh, yeah, let's do intermission.
Yeah,
I forgot.
Let's
dive into our intermission, everybody.
Then we get to the dude.
And then we talk about the dude because he abides. Let's start with our movie quote competition. This one's for me. You don't listen, do you? I don't think you ever really hear me. You just ask the same questions every week. How's your job? Are you having any negative thoughts? All I have are negative thoughts.
Oh, I know this. I'll give everyone a second. Joker.
Yes. Joker.
Great, great, great one. Great movie. Okay, I have a quote. You're a very nosy fellow, kitty cat, huh? You know what happens to nosy fellows, huh? No? Want to guess, huh? No? Okay. They lose their noses.
Say that again.
You're a very nosy fellow, kitty cat, huh? You know what happens to nosy fellows, huh? Want to guess? No? Okay. They lose their noses.
I don't know.
Chinatown.
Oh, man. JJ Gitz.
Yep. That's when he gets his nose cut.
Yeah. That's a great special effects shot, too.
It's fantastic.
Really good practical effects.
It's so good. It seems like he really got his nose cut off.
That makes me cringe every time I watch it. All right. Guess this movie release year. Tron.
The original?
The original Tron. Tron.
Tron.
Tron. Tron.
Oh, man. I'm going to go with... it's the 80s. I'm going to go with 1982.
Yeah.
Yes! Oh, my God.
Straight guess. You were like sulking into the microphone.
I almost said it. I thought it was 81, but then I just, for some reason, two. I think I twin telepathied you.
Maybe.
I think so.
All right. Your turn.
Jack Nicholson's movie, Five Easy Pieces, which he was nominated for an Oscar for.
1978.
70. It's an oldie.
It's that old.
It's an oldie.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
All right.
It's pretty young in it.
Movie pop quiz time.
Let's go.
How many Oscars has Frances McDormand won, and what are the films she has won for?
Easy peasy. This is Child's Play. Fargo. She's won 3. Fargo. 3 Billboards. And then Nomadland.
3 Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Yep.
Yeah, you got the second part right. The first part you got wrong. She has 4 Oscars.
Wait, she has 4 Oscars?
She has a producing Oscar credit for Nomadland.
Oh, my God.
Trick question. Gotcha. I knew I'd get you with that.
Damn,
you're so cocky going into that. Oh, this is Child's Play. Oh, you're a fucking idiot, Jim.
I never said that.
Sorry.
I never said that. I love how you take that as me insulting you.
All right, your turn.
You're a fucking idiot, Jim.
That was a good trick question.
I got you,
you
man.
Worded it. I was just thinking straight up acting.
I've been waiting to pull it out. I was
look
like,
at that smile on your
face. I'm
going
to get you this time.
You're so happy.
I'm going to crack open a new LaCroix because I'm so happy.
Let's hear that crack.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
How happy would you be if we got LaCroix as a sponsor?
Dude, I'd be ecstatic.
This kid, I swear to God.
Tell the story.
All he drinks his LaCroix.
Well, tell the story.
Okay. The other day, we were going to the grocery store.
This is when we got back from our flight from being in Boston.
Going to the grocery store. I'm driving.
And then all of a sudden I hear, I turn over, I look over, Jim's drinking a LaCroix. He brought it, it was in my cup holder.
I was driving.
You were driving, yeah, yeah.
It was like 5 minutes into the ride.
Oh my God.
We're on the highway, he just hears,
I've seen the LaCroix in my car too. 2 weeks ago, I went in my car, there was an empty LaCroix in the cup holder.
Bro, I love LaCroix. I love him.
He drinks it like it's a drug.
Every day, man. It's so good.
When we're away, you drink so many soda waters because you didn't have any. Every chance you got, every time I looked at him during Thanksgiving, he had a soda water in his hand.
So addicted to soda water. So addicted to it.
Oh, man. Anyways.
All right. Who's our hater of the week?
Oh, I'm not. I got to do my quiz.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Jeez, man.
Sorry, man.
Okay. What famous movie director starred in Chinatown? It's toughie. Oh, I thought you would get this. Do you want a hint?
Sure.
He ended up becoming Jack Nicholson's stepfather.
Who did Jack marry?
Oh, you don't know who Jack married?
I forget. I can't remember. Yeah, you got me.
John Huston.
Oh, crap.
Yeah. You're Angelica right. Huston is his daughter.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. He married Angelica Huston. Yeah. They got divorced eventually, right?
Yeah, but they were married for 30 years.
Yeah, for a while.
Yeah. They have a couple of kids.
Yeah. Angelica's great. Got her on a poster right here.
Yeah, she's right there.
Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah. Yeah, John Huston, he was a great director, and he was also a pretty successful actor, and he had a great career. And Daniel Day-Lewis based some of his accent in There Will Be Blood off of John Huston.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Jack actually wanted to be a director, but someone convinced him to be an actor.
And they end up becoming one of the best ever.
Probably the best ever. All right, who's our hater of the week? You got any real ones?
No, I have an unsubscriber.
Got a couple unsubscribes? Love to hear them.
I can't wait to tell you.
Here we go. The anticipation. I'm just going to keep sipping my LaCroix.
Okay. I posted a Interstellar clip, and Hunter Melendez wrote, "The nerve they must have to think they don't understand Interstellar's complexity enough to have a Q&A on it." Unsubscribe, referring to our Patreon Q&A.
So biggest supporter of this episode is Kadarius Cook, our friend on Instagram and TikTok. He made us these amazing shirts that have our logo, Raiders of the Lost Podcast, embroidered beautifully on there. We'll show an image on the YouTube version right now. So, Kadarius, thank you so much for these shirts. You can check out his apparel at nirvanascreation.com.
Also, his Instagram and TikTok handles are KadariusKD. He's an amazing guy, does really talented embroidery work. Thanks so much, pal.
And so we also have a couple of 5-star reviews.
Ooh.
Two of them I'll read off. So, great commentary. This is from Say It Ain't Lewis. These guys are great. Love their commentary and takes. Lots of fun. Thanks, Lewis. And then from Lil Man Goozy, wow, unsubscribed. One of my absolute favorite podcasts. Definitely the only film podcast I found that I genuinely listen to, all narrated by fun film geniuses. Whoa, I like that word. Would love to see an episode talking about Stranger Things. Love you guys. Keep up the good work. We're actually going to do Stranger Things as soon as that season. Well, maybe we'll do like a...
Before season four.
We'll do seasons 1 through 3 soon. Yeah. That'd be actually a lot of fun because we actually really like Stranger Things. It's a great show. On this day in film history, today is Thursday, December 2nd. In 1988, The Naked Gun was released. In 2013, The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug premiered. In 2016, Jackie was released. And happy birthday to Lucy Liu.
I have a real hater. I found him.
You found a real hater?
Yeah.
Let's go.
Who okay. Got? I posted, this guy's a fucking D-bag. Oh my God. I posted a clip on Jurassic Park. So the water cups with the ripples in the water. The way they made that effect happen was naturally they fixed a guitar string, an acoustic guitar string, underneath the dashboard of the car right below the cups, and then they flicked the guitar string, and that created natural ripples in the water to make it look like it was a T-Rex
stomping.
And so really cool practical effects. So that's what the clip was about. And then Nice Combo 6 wrote, "This podcast is just the Wikipedia article, ... And I wrote, "Our podcast is actually 90 minutes of film analysis, and this is just our TikTok page." And then he replied, "I've seen it. This was the highlight, ... I just didn't respond. I was like, what a douchebag. Are you kidding me, man?
I wouldn't have even responded if I was you. I don't respond to people who say stuff like that because who cares?
It's like, dude, get a life.
He's just living in his mom's basement, just eating Hot Pockets and licorice. And
what are you even doing watching our videos, bro?
Haters gonna hate, ainers gonna ain't.
He wants that peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
All right, my stream recommendation for this episode is The Office Christmas episodes. So obviously The Office is on Peacock. Four specifically that I choose as my favorites, because I think there's 7 or 8 total.
So these are your top four.
Top four Office Christmas episodes. In no order. So we got Christmas Party, which is season 2, episode 10. That also has the Yankee swap inside of it. Secret Santa, season 6, episode 13. Really great one. And we also have Moroccan Christmas, season 5, episode 11. And then Benihana Christmas, season 3, episode 10 and 11. And that's a great one as well.
Is that your favorite episode?
Benihana Christmas?
Yeah.
No. Like, probably Dinner Party.
Dinner Party.
There's like a handful of more that I put above Benihana Christmas. Benihana Christmas is great. But we're actually going to do an Office episode pretty soon. And
do you all want an Office episode?
They definitely want
it. Yeah, we're thinking
about
it.
Whether they want it or not, or know that they want it, it's happening. And they're just
going to get delivered.
They're going to have to accept it. All right.
They're going to have to deal with it.
What's your streaming recommendation?
Sorry. I picked The Constant Gardener on Amazon Prime. It just got put on the platform. It's a really great drama. Stars Ralph Fiennes and Rachel Weisz. She won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress in this movie. Really fantastic film. I highly recommend it. Now, before we move on to the dude, I got to tell you all about movieposters.com, the number one place to get your posters online today. Head on over to movieposters.com and use our special promo code Raiders10 to get 10% off your order today. The holidays are coming. There's no better present to get the film lover in your life than a movie poster of their favorite film. Movieposters.com has all sorts of sizes, framing, backlighting, whatever your poster needs are, they can handle it. They have pretty much every film and TV show imaginable at their arsenal. Head on over to movieposters.com. Use our promo code Raiders10 and get 10% off your order today. And our other amazing sponsor, Arc Studio Pro, is the most efficient, streamlined, and elegant screenwriting software on the market. They have teamed up with us to offer a very special discount, $30 off their membership. If you follow the link, arcstudiopro.com/Raiders. Again, arcstudiopro.com/Raiders. Arc Studio Pro is the best screenwriting software I have ever used. They have all sorts of really cool perks, like this plot board, which allows you to easily organize your plot points with this basically like a digital flashcard drag and drop system. Super helpful with organizing. They also have all sorts of apps for your desktop or phone. Online collaboration with co-writers, super helpful outlining tools, revisionist management, and even links to feedback so people can give you feedback on your writing. Now, all you got to do is head on over to arcstudiopro.com/Raiders to get $30 off and start writing today.
All right, we've been talking a lot about Fargo. Let's dive into some Big Lebowski. We'll bounce back and forth, obviously, because there's still some more stuff.
I love bouncing back and forth.
There's some other stuff I want to talk about with Fargo, but, you know, let's talk about the
people
dude.
Want the dude.
Let's talk about him. We've been saving him. So the dude played by Jeff Bridges, probably his best role. The dude's the man. He fits right in where he is. I love the character. He's just the laziest person alive. He writes checks for 69 cents at the grocery store to get cream or milk for his white Russians, which he drinks constantly. I love that scene so much. He's just in the grocery store drinking the milk and smelling it and writing a check for 69 cents.
And he's got cream on his mustache.
He's completely incompetent, but you can't help but root for the dude. The entire film, he's this completely broke stoner, drinks these white Russians, smokes bulls. It's kind of ridiculous, and he's like the ultimate underdog too, where, like I said, he's this hero's journey that he's on is it's so ridiculous, it's daunting, but we love to just watch him like as he progresses from being the laziest stoner alive to like kind of like a little bit of a detective towards the end.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Kind of.
Well, I would say
a little bit.
The dude doesn't change at all. He's a static character. He doesn't change in any way.
But he gets more like kind of intrigued or interested in the plot.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing with the dude is, I think that this is the Coen's interpretation of the idiot, which follows a character who is oblivious to like the world around him, who finds himself caught in these crazy circumstances and these plots of other characters, and he's kind of a fool, and not he's just very slow. I think this is the Coen brothers' interpretation of that character, of someone who shouldn't be in these situations but is. He doesn't really even drive the story forward, wanting it to go forward, but just things happen to him. And the world around him changes, but Lebowski doesn't change. The dude just stays the same, man.
Yeah, you could say it. You're right. At the end of the film, he's like basically the same person.
Still the dude.
Despite all the experiences he just had, despite, you know, Donnie dying and everything. Everything that's happened to him impregnating a woman probably is just, he's just the dude now still.
Because that's what the dude's entire persona is, and that's how he lives his life of, you know, just, he's the dude. Dude.
I'm the dude.
No matter what happens.
Deuterino, yeah. Your dudeness.
No matter what happens around him, no matter how the world changes, you know, he just is going to sit back and keep coasting regardless. No matter how crazy the story gets, he's still just going to, you know, sit back in his chair, relax, and put his sunglasses on and drink a White Russian.
Yeah.
That's the whole idea of the character.
I think critics are just so blind to how good this movie actually is.
It's so funny.
There's so much attention to detail to the acting, the writing. Every time I watch it, I always find something new, I feel like.
I bet critics, they didn't understand the character.
They didn't understand the movie.
Yeah, the whole point of the dude.
It's like Burn After Reading. That's one of the Coen Brothers movies that it's kind of hard to get your first time. For some people, I love that movie. That movie is hysterical. I think it's very funny, very good, really great script.
Osborne.
But like, versus Fargo is like a clear cut. You know what the movie's about, but Big Lebowski, maybe not everyone gets it their first time.
They don't get the humor, I think, at first. I think it's, for me, Lebowski gets better on repeat viewings.
Yeah, I think also people are put off by like the stuff like the dream sequences maybe. They're like, what is the point of this whole thing? Why are we doing this and everything? I just think they don't understand. I also think that maybe people just don't like the character of the dude.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't like those kinds of people in real life despite having no effect on their lives. And they're like, why do I have to watch a whole movie about this guy just drinking White Russians and chilling in a bathrobe? But I love every second of it.
Just the creation of the character. And Jeff Bridges, he will go down mostly remembered for this because he perfectly embodied the character. And I read that when he met with the Coens, he's like, did you guys grow up with me? Because this is what I was like when I was in high school. He's like, did you guys know me? And he even used a lot of his own clothes for the film. So a lot of the dude's clothes are Jeff Bridges' clothes that he brought for the movie.
That's so funny.
Like one of the bathrobes, a lot of the t-shirts and shorts.
I think the sandals too, like clear like Jesus sandals.
They're called Jules. Yeah. They're pretty big sandals back then. They're a big fashion trend, and he was always wearing them on his own, and then he was like, hey, the dude should wear these sandals. That's something the dude would wear.
Yeah. But the whole movie is a parody. It's a parody on these same tropes, these same characters, kidnapping movies. And I think my favorite example of this movie being a parody is like about like halfway, three quarters through the film, he's having that drink at that guy's house. And he's trying to like figure out what's going on with this, with the kidnapping and everything. He's trying to find the money. He's in deep shit. He's in over his head. And the guy takes a call and writes on the notepad. And then he leaves the room. Then the dude gets up real quick. He takes a pencil. And we're watching. He's like, oh, he's gonna scratch out what's on the pad. And we're going to see what the guy wrote. It's going to be amazing. And it's just a stick figure with a huge erection. And it's just like, that's what the whole movie is. That's the whole movie. That's it. It's a giant parody joke.
Yeah, and same thing with when they go to Larry's house. And then he destroys the car. This is what happens when you F a stranger in the ass. This is what happens. Larry,
you're gonna want to look out the window, Larry.
Walter just messes that car up, and it's the neighbor's car. Yeah. It's so funny. Oh, is Larry the same kid from Fargo, Jerry's son? I think it is.
Maybe.
I think it could be because this movie was only made 2 years after.
Kind of looks like him.
After Fargo, I think it is the same kid.
Kind of looks
because
like
it's funny because Larry doesn't even say a word. Yeah, it's so amazing. But like, the story gets so ridiculous and complex and complicated. I just really love like the interweave, like how wild the plot gets and all the zany characters. You got Julianne Moore as Maude, and then you have Peter Stormare again as the nihilist.
Nihilist one.
Was it Hungus? Or
yeah, I think it's Hungus.
Carl Hungus. Carl Hungus.
Or Victor Hungus.
No, it's Carl.
Carl.
And then you got Philip Seymour Hoffman as Brent, and then, you know, the Big Lebowski, he's funny in this. And just the cast of characters are so great. You know, Jesus, you know, John Turturro. And I think this is when the Coen brothers really understood, like, the power of wardrobe. Because there are famous wardrobes in this movie. You got John Turturro's character, the purple jumpsuit as Jesus. And then Walters, he's always got the vest. and like cargo shorts and combat boots,
the yellow sunglasses.
His sunglasses, and then the dude's always in a bathrobe or something very relaxed like that. And I think that these are all like these are Halloween costumes. You know what I mean? And so I think the Coen brothers, when you make a cult classic like this, and you have great wardrobe, that really resonates with people. Like, people dress up as these characters for Halloween. And it's not a scary movie. It's not a fantastical movie, but it's a loved movie.
Yeah, in both films, Fargo and Lebowski have these kidnapping plots. Obviously, in Fargo, there's actually a real kidnapping. There are murders, and Jerry's wife eventually gets murdered as well. So there's an actual real kidnapping set up by Jerry that goes completely wrong. And Jerry, obviously, at the end of the film, gets caught after hiding out for who knows how long. Whereas in The Big Lebowski...
Sorry, I love Jerry's arrest scene.
Oh, Jerry's like super, super crying.
Yeah. They pull him out of the way. He's like, no! No!
So then the kidnapping in Lebowski is the supposedly rich Lebowski hires the dude to be a courier because his trophy wife Bunny has been kidnapped. And he needs her to get her back with $1 million in the briefcase.
And they suspect that it's the two guys that broke into the dude's apartment earlier.
And peed on his carpet because it really tied the room together. But really, they just wanted some doofus, some throwaway guy to be the person in this position to do it.
Isn't this guy supposed to be like a millionaire?
And then we're not morons.
you're not the only... No, they say, you're not the only moron here.
But the irony of it is there was no kidnapping. The Big Lebowski, the rich one, isn't rich. It's really Maude and her mother's money. He has no part of the family expenses and finances. The kidnapping was fake so that he could get money. It's similar to Jerry, whereas the kidnapping was real. And the irony in Fargo is even though Carl hides all the cash in the snow, no one ever gets it. Some probably random driver in the spring probably drives by and gets all that money. So ironically, no one gets money in either film because...
It was Llewellyn Moss.
Yeah, Llewellyn Moss got the case. That's what's so great. The movies are full of characters who are greedy as hell. No one gets any money.
Yeah, I love it. And they're all kind of like anti-heroes. There's like no one in this film that you can really like feel like, oh, they're a great person.
Donnie, you could say, is like the only...
Donnie, okay, yeah.
Or Donnie, yeah. But you just have nothing but pity for him.
Shut the F up, Donnie.
Because Donnie's always like two steps back in the conversation. He was like, oh, wait, what?
Mark it down, dude. What's funny is you actually don't see the dude bowl.
Yeah.
It's always Donnie and Walter.
The whole movie.
And the only time you actually see him, like you could say he's bowling is in the dance sequence. Like But it's not technically...
No. Yeah. Well, Maude's the one who bowls it.
Yeah, exactly. He's like helping her bowl.
Yeah.
That's the only time you ever actually see the dude bowl in a bowling alley.
Another example of great irony in the film.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
But we actually, James and I, we grew up bowling.
Oh, yeah, dude.
And we had our own bowling balls.
But it wasn't 10 pin like in this movie.
Okay,
So in New England and in Canada, they do have the big ball, 10 pin bowling with you throw two balls and you have the big fat pins, the huge ball.
And the balls with the holes in them.
That's called 10 pin bowling. That's the most common around America. But in New England, we also have candle pin bowling. And it's also in Canada. And I think maybe in the Midwest too, where the balls are much smaller. They're about the size of a softball. The pins are much thinner. They're like the size of this ball.
Yeah, they're
right
very
here.
Skinny. And they're tall.
And they're tall. And so you get three balls instead of two. Three throws per box. So it's different. That's what we play.
Because it's harder to knock them all down.
Yeah, it's much harder. It's way easier to throw that big fat ball. And it's a lot more fun. But I love candlepin bowling.
Yeah, so that's something we grew up with.
And that's why I love this movie.
It's ironic. We never watched it. Our brothers, I don't think, were ever really into Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually didn't get into Big Lebowski until I was an adult.
Yeah, we grew up in bowling alleys. Yeah. Like we bowled every weekend.
I feel like we would have really loved this movie as kids. Yeah. It's something we'd never watched. Ironically, we didn't watch this a lot growing up.
Yeah.
I honestly was pretty late to Lebowski.
I was too.
I was, and
like
I
a teenager.
Knowing it so well now, I'm like, I can't believe I never watched this movie until like I was like 20.
Because that's what I mean. Like Fargo's famous, but Lebowski's more of a cult movie.
Definitely. It's a cult classic.
Yeah.
It's so crazy how big it is because the character of the dude in Lebowski, just the Big Lebowski, the movie, it's so loved. There's a annual festival where people dress up as the dude and it's a big concert and it's the dude has his own day. It's March 6th. It's called the Day of the Dude. And Jeff Bridges even played music at some of the concerts.
Yeah, he's a great musician.
And
anyone seen Crazy Heart?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, and So according to the Dude's Paper, which is the official Dude newspaper, the official publication, so the Day of the Dude is celebrated, and there's also a dude religion called Dudism. And people who are part of this religion call themselves Dudists. And on March 6th every year, they have White Russians watch Lebowski and then go bowling. And then also, so Dudism was founded in 2005 by an American journalist. And the official name of this church is the Church of the Latter-day Dude. And despite its name, the comedic origin, occasional criticism of the religion, Dudism isn't regarded as a parody, but as a real religion. And they basically, it's like a state of mind of kind of like Taoism, of Buddhism-esque. So it's like it borrows, like, they actually do practice it, but it borrows from other religions. And they basically like think like, oh, this is like how the dude lives his life, so it must be like kind of like that religion.
He just smokes J's and chills in the tub.
Yeah, drinks White Russians.
But that sounds like a lot of fun. Yeah. And the dude is obviously such an iconic character. People don't even haven't even seen The Big Lebowski. They know the dude. They know who the dude is. They can picture it in their head. They've seen photos of him all over the place for over the years. You know, posters and everything.
And the term dude wasn't really that big until the 90s. It was the term dude has gone through different meanings. It originated in the UK and began cropping up in popular culture.
Did it mean the same thing in the UK?
Yeah. No, it started out as something different. It meant skirt in Scottish. It was the name for it was like duddis or some duddist, and that meant like a man's skirt. And then it just evolved into what we know it is today, but in popular culture it was still growing in the 80s. In the 80s it really took off, especially with I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of this movie with Bill and Ted. Obviously, they say dude all the time.
You forgot the name of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. The way you said it was like a foreign film. Like, oh, I can't remember the name. I can't remember the name of this film on the IFC channel, on the Criterion channel. Oh, what was it called? Excellent.
I hold that as high regard as, you know, as foreign films. It's a great movie. But so the term dude was getting popularized in the 80s, and I think with this movie really solidified dude as being a commonplace term. And now, like, we grew up saying dude constantly.
I always assumed that dude was super common at the time. But, yeah, I mean, you could probably say this helped it out a lot.
Yeah.
And the dude, obviously, a great character. But I also love Walter.
Walter's amazing.
John Goodman, so, so good in this movie. This guy can do anything. It's so funny when you watch it and you also realize that he's Sully in Monsters, Inc. Because this character's insane. He's wildly funny. He's obsessed with his tour in Vietnam. He's a Vietnam War vet. He relates every situation, every conversation to Vietnam and the lives that were lost in Vietnam. He's overly confident. He gets them all into more and more trouble. And, like, every dilemma that he inserts himself into in the dude's life,
amateurs,
he approaches it like he's, like, the ultimate warrior, the ultimate soldier, despite the fact that he has, like, no skills, really, or maybe at the end of the film you could say he proves himself, but, like, he's never successful at what he's trying to do.
Fucking amateurs.
He keeps saying, he's like laughing to himself. He's like, fucking amateurs.
Bunch of amateurs.
But he just ruins everything. Ruins everything.
So, and I love before the drop off, when the dude goes to pick him up and then he goes into the driver's seat. He's like, where are you going? He's like, I got this dude. He's like, give him the ringer. It's my stinky undies.
But it's ironic. He throws a ringer to what we find out is a ringer.
Yeah.
So there's never any money. So there's so much irony in this film. It's so fun.
Yeah. And I love the costume. He's always wearing his dog tags. But when Walter pulls out the gun on Smokey, when Smokey crosses the line
because when he's bullied.
Oh my God. That's such a crazy scene. It is so funny. It's unbelievable. And then the cops show up in the background when him and Walter are talking in the car. It's so ridiculous. It's such a great moment for the character.
And I love the bowling alley because obviously we love bowling alleys. Bowling's one of my favorite things to do in the world. But also it's like the second storyline of the film is the bowling tournament that's happening at the time. And it has nothing to do with the plot of the movie, of the kidnapping or anything, but it's constantly cross-cut and both sequences and timelines are going on together. And even though Jesus, that character, has nothing to do with the plot, really, and even though Totoro is so funny in it, that's what the Coen brothers do. They have these characters, you could say, that don't really add to the plot. Same thing with Mike Yaganita. He doesn't need to be in the movie, you could say, even though there's a reason for him to be there, but it helps build the world, it helps build the characters, it helps us create the tone of the film and add so much to the soul of the film, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it seems like it's the perfect hobby for the dude. It's like the most relaxed sport, even more relaxed than golf.
And you don't have to be an athlete to bowl and be a great bowler.
Anyone can be a good bowler. You don't need to be in shape, and you spend most of your time sitting down, you know? So it's just like a perfect thing for the dude to be obsessed with. Because like, even when he's at home, he's listening to tapes of bowling, like just the sound effects of bowling.
The playoffs.
Yeah, it's just great. It's just perfect for the dude. It's like, obviously, and I read that the backstory for the dude is that he is an heir to the person who created the Rubik's Cube. And so he received an inheritance from that person who died, and now he's run out of the money. So that's why he's never had a job. He never had to work.
That's pretty funny. There's so many other great characters. So the Big Lebowski, played by David Huddleston, really great character, very funny. And then his assistant, Brandt, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. The Hop is so good in this movie. I feel like he steals every scene he's in. He's perfect as like this weasel-y, uppity guy who like thinks that his boss and employer is this very wealthy and important man, where really it's the exact opposite, where the Big Lebowski doesn't have anything to his own name. It's really all of his ex-wife's money. It's really
all talk.
All of his daughter's money. Maude, who has maybe the funniest film entrance I've ever seen in my life.
It's the best entrance ever.
It's so, it's great because Lebowski shows up at her big apartment. It's like empty. There's weird noises and like breathing going on. And then all of a sudden she comes flying like in the shadows. Like it looks like she looks like she's going to stab him, but she's just painting. And people are flinging her across the ceiling.
Yeah, it's so funny.
Because it's a parody of pretentious artists.
Yeah.
It's like she's flying on a ceiling with ropes to paint.
It's based on a real artist.
Is it really?
A real woman did that, and she was like a famous painter in New York. So it's based on a real thing. Julianne Moore is so great as Maude. Her accent, the way she talks, it's perfect. The snobby, yuppie, rich.
Does the female form make you uncomfortable?
Vagina.
Does the word vagina make you feel uncomfortable? Vagina?
Oh my God. She's really great in this movie. It's one of my favorite roles of hers. And you can see, when I watch Coen Brothers movies, you can see a lot of early Paul Thomas Anderson tone.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that PTA has always been a massive fan of the Coens, which is why he's even cast some of their usual actors, like William H. Macy a few times in The Hoff, and then Julianne Moore a couple of times. So I think that I feel there's like a kinship between PTA's early movies and the Coen Brothers' dark comedies.
I completely like Boogie Nights feels very tonally similar to like Lebowski,
definitely.
You know,
and
what I mean?
Punch Drunk Love, and Heart Eight as well, like Fargo.
I could see that for sure,
definitely. And then Peter Stormare as Nihilist Number One. That's his, literally his character name. But also Carl Hungus is like in the porno. The porno's so funny.
The cable's out. Oh, what's he gonna do? You can only imagine what happens next. He fixes the cable.
It's so funny. I love the cast of characters in this movie.
Tara Reid is Bunny. Who came out before
she blew up.
Was this like
98?
Post American Pie.
This is when Number One came out. Number One came out in 98, I believe.
Yeah, you're right.
Maybe even earlier. It could have been earlier.
American Pie, Number One. Let me look it up real quick.
It might have been 98.
I'm curious.
I guess. But she was a huge star for like 5 straight years. She was big time.
1999, American Pie.
99, okay.
Okay, you're right.
No, I was wrong. I was wrong.
I mean, you're right that it was
later.
That it was later.
Okay, yeah. Yes, I did say that.
Yeah, but she's solid as Bunny in this. Perfectly cast.
I love how she ended up she went on vacation with her friends.
And the Nihilist cut off their girlfriend's toe because they thought they were going to get money.
Again, another problem solved by cell phones.
Ironically, there was never any money again.
Mm-hmm. And I love the Jesus character. Did you know John Turturro made a Jesus movie?
Of this character?
Yeah, last year.
I had no idea.
I mean, this year it came out. It came out on VOD.
I got to look that up.
He made a film. I can't remember what it's called, but it's the character 30 years later.
And he's still bowling?
I think so, yeah. But he's not like as ridiculous. I think they made it a new more nuanced approach. But although I'm not sure that it could work because he's a pedophile.
Yeah, it's true.
So I don't think that it could. I don't think it was a good idea to make it.
The Jesus roles,
yes. Yeah, you didn't see trailers for it?
20% of Rotten Tomatoes came out in February 2020.
Yeah, okay, last year it came out.
Wow, it has a pretty good cast.
Who's the lead actress in it? It's his romantic interest.
Audrey Tautou from Emily.
Tattoo.
And then Susan Sarandon, John Hamm, Pete Davidson, Christopher Walken. Wow, he must have a lot of friends for sure.
Well, yeah, he's John Turturro. He's a great guy.
He's super cool.
But I just think it was a bad idea to make a movie about a pedophile.
Yeah, you can't do that because he's the character's hysterical, but when you learn he's a pedophile, you're like, Jesus.
He's a better ass.
Jesus.
8-year-olds.
Exactly.
8-year-olds, dude.
And you never forget it.
But that scene, the flashback, because the Coen brothers rarely do something like flashbacks, but it works because it's a really funny joke of seeing Jesus walk through the neighborhoods having to tell his neighbors that he's a convicted sex offender.
And they let you use your imagination as to what happens when he opens the door.
Exactly. It's so funny. So what is White Russian's vodka?
Milk
and Kahlua.
Kahlua.
All right. Did you have to make those a ton?
As a bartender? No, drinks like that's not like a common drink, really.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a fad drink in the 90s, but I don't think I've ever made a White Russian that someone asked for. Kahlua people ask for sometimes, but it's not a common drink that people have, you know.
I think
that's more of like a home drink to make, because can you really trust milk at like a bar?
No way. Because James and I used to both work in restaurants, and whenever someone would order something with cream, and every once in a while people would order a White Russian, and I'd be like, you really want restaurant cream? And it's like, come on.
Well, I'm sure most restaurants, if they have to put cream in a drink, they're using the little, like the Coffee Mate ones that they get for
coffee. We never did in any of the restaurants I did. They were always like old cartons that have been sitting in the walk-in fridge.
But yeah, man, you can't trust the milk and cream that's in restaurants, especially when alcohol is involved, because it masks if it's rotten or
exactly.
If it's gone bad.
Yeah. But I love the idea of the White Russian with the dude. He drinks so many of them. Like, he's like in the limo, he's drinking it, and then he gets pulled
into— Watch a dude, I got a drink!
He pulls it into the other limo.
That's so funny. He gets kidnapped out of a limo into another limo.
It's so great. And then when he gets to Maj's loft, he's like, do you have any Kahlua? It's like everywhere he goes, he needs to drink a White Russian.
And the
it's
thing
amazing.
Is, Kahlua's not like common to have at home. Like,
I've
had like a Kahlua kick before. Like, I was like, the Kahlua's bomb.
Yeah.
With some milk, it's like a chocolate milk liquid drink.
Yeah.
You know, it's delicious. But like, I don't know many people that just have Kahlua on hand.
Yeah, it's great.
If they even have a bar set up at their house.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's just a funny character trait for the dude, for sure.
But also, Jeff Bridges, he actually imbues a really great performance. It's really great behavior of the dude. It's something that he does a bunch of times is like when he's in a situation where he's losing an argument and he just gives up, because that's the dude. He just if he doesn't want to fight, he doesn't want to keep fighting, he'll just like, you know what, screw you. And what he does is he puts his sunglasses on. You'll see that he does it when he's arguing with the Big Lebowski, when he's talking to the police officers, and a couple other times where, you know, when he's losing the conversation, he just, you know what, screw this, put my sunglasses on, you have my minimal attention now, and I'm going to sit back in this chair, and that's it. He does that a lot, and that's a really great behavioral tick that Jeff Bridges imbued in the character.
Yeah, I think that alludes to what the stranger's talking about, especially at the end of the film, and the first time we meet him, you know, where I take pride knowing that, like, someone like that's out there taking it easy for all of us sinners out there. Sam Elliott's amazing, amazing voice.
He's like, got the best voice ever.
He's got the best voice and, like, best hair. Like, the thickest hair and thickest facial hair I've ever seen in my life.
I'm jealous of that guy's hair.
Man, that guy's got a mop on his head still. But that guy's voice is amazing.
Yeah.
It's such a great choice for the stranger, who obviously you can interpret as being God.
Is that how you interpret him?
Yeah, that's how I interpret him.
I interpret him as the Coens, as the storytellers.
Well, that's pretty good.
As the ones telling the story.
But how come he brings up the cussing?
Because I guess because that is the only way to tell the story.
Yeah, I think it's more of like a
it could be, it could be God.
A metaphor of Jesus or God.
Yeah. I like to think of it as he's the storyteller.
Because I sometimes look at the dude and I see like it's maybe that's an interpretation of Jesus in a way.
The dude is the Jesus?
Yeah, I mean, even the character design is similar to Jesus. You know, he's got the long hair, the beard. He's got a cloak. He's got
the sandals.
Got the sandals. That's what I mean. I always see it as an interpretation of Jesus in a way.
Who's Judas?
Who's Judas in the movie?
Well, Maud is Mary Magdalene.
Yeah. Come on, Jesus and Mary Mags were just friends, Anthony.
Yeah, just friends.
They were just friends.
Just friends.
This is blasphemy, what you're insinuating, that they were more than buds. They're just best buds. He helped her get through some tough times.
Then the big Lebowski is Judas, the betrayer.
The Big Lebowski, you could say
because he set him up
to
fail. The scheme.
Yeah, you can say it. But Judas was a friend of Jesus, if you want to get into Catholicism.
He
was a disciple. Big Lebowski isn't a disciple of the.
I'm just saying.
I know.
Well, you're saying the dude is Jesus.
But you said he betrays him. He doesn't. He barely betrays him.
Yeah, he does.
He sets. They're not friends.
He completely betrays him.
Okay, he betrays him. But
he sets him up on a job to be the courier for, even though he scammed him the whole time.
He's not betraying a friend.
Well, I never said they were friends.
But you said he was Judas.
A Judas character. We're going to die. I'm going to betray you.
Whoa. What are you going to do?
I don't know. There'll be something good. That'll be a great betrayal.
That's a weird threat to say to someone. I'm going to betray you. Someday I'm going to betray you, Anthony.
I have the high ground.
I hate you.
And the Big Lebowski is... without a doubt, the Coens' most creative film, and they got into surrealist territory with the two dream sequences, and it's something they've never done since.
Well, you can say Hail Caesar is similar to the Gutterball sequence with the classic Hollywood musical numbers and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah, but that's just a production of a
film. I know,
film.
But still, it looks similar.
Yeah,
you know?
But I'm talking like surrealist, like it's not real.
Yeah, flying over Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think that. They had so much creativity. I would have loved to see them do something. I would love to see them do something else like that again, because it's really well done. It's super funny. The Deakins really crafted it perfectly. One of my favorite shots of all time, is the POV inside the bowling ball when it's rolling down the alley and it gets to the and it hits the pins, because Deakins just keeps the camera in it and it makes you dizzy every time you see it and you feel like you're going up and down. It's really an amazing shot.
Well, so the detail of the shot where Maude is at the front of the lane, she had bowled the ball, so you can even see Maude in her green coat.
It's an unbelievable practical effect that I'm sure Deakins had a lot of input in. I would love to see Deakins do more stuff like that. All of these guys had done more like surrealist films, I think they could have come up with some really interesting stuff.
Yeah, they got
just
very creative.
The brilliant minds of the three guys.
Especially even like the shot of during the Gutterball sequence where the dude like comes around that corner, is that enormous wall that he's dancing in front of and the huge shadow. It's like really cool. It's almost like a Beetlejuice looking movie shot.
Exactly. I really love it. I think they're so creative, and Deakins being a practical filmmaker and a practical lighter lit it beautifully. But that bowling ball shot is really astounding. Yeah. And that entire sequence is so much fun. It's great.
It is super funny.
Amazing production design. And I had never noticed, because we watched it recently, but Maude's dressed in the same outfit as one of the statues in the Big Lebowski's home. Same outfit, except that she just has the bowling balls on her chest, but otherwise it's like the exact same outfit as that statue.
Oh, in the dream sequence?
Yeah.
Like the Trojan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so outfit. There's a statue. When Brand opens the safe, there's a bronze statue wearing that outfit. And I was like, oh, that's what Maude wears.
But I ultimately like the end of Big Lebowski too, because we get like the twist ending where we find out that, you know, there was never any money. Bunny never kidnapped herself. It was all a joke. There's phone books inside the Ringer briefcase. It's just like a funny, clever twist, a cherry on top of the great film in general.
What's your favorite scene in Lebowski?
My favorite scene in the Big Lebowski? Wow, you're putting me on the spot.
You better be ready, man.
Well, what's
the
yours
betrayal's
for,
coming.
Let me think. Yeah. You say yours first, and I'll think.
I think that my favorite scene might be the Larry scene with the car.
No, I was just about to say.
When he destroys the car.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
This is what happens, Larry! It's so funny. It's so funny.
Walter's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then when he gives the speech for Donnie with the ashes, and he brings up Vietnam again. The dude's like, what's up with that shit? With like,
what are you talking about, man?
What are you talking about? And then they meet the writer, Larry's dad.
Yeah. He's an honor to meet you,
he's
sir.
In the iron lung. He's like, I just want to say, huge fan.
And she's like, he asks his wife, is he still working? And she's like, he has health problems.
He's in an iron lung.
That's so funny. And I think that the scene, the first break-in scene of the dude's apartment is really a perfect scene. You learn who the character is, what he's like in this crazy situation, and it's super funny. I think that's a perfect scene.
And his involvement in the entire scenario of this fake kidnapping is because he wanted the Big Lebowski to compensate him for a carpet that got peed on that really tied the room together by the people that were looking for him.
The only reason why he's even involved is because these idiots broke into his house and then he wanted his rug replaced.
He doesn't want money. He just wants his carpet. That's all he wants.
Well, he wants money.
Not really.
Yeah, I mean, when he's in the Big Lebowski's limo, he's asking if he could give the $10,000 right there But really, Lebowski's handing him the envelope with the finger, with the toenail in it. The toe in
it. Actually, you're right. He does want money.
The dude always wants
money. Well, because he's offered money for the job.
Yeah.
But his involvement in the entire plot is because he just wants his carpet.
Oh, yeah, that. But he does want money because he has none.
Yeah. He's got rent due.
Yeah. He's a little greedy.
Not very greedy, though.
He's a little. Just a little greedy.
Hey, if someone offered you 10 grand to do something, you'd probably, probably ask for it.
100%.
Even though you failed at achieving it. Because Walter threw out a ringer and jumped out of the car.
When he jumps
with
out of
an
the car.
Uzi. With an Uzi.
Oh my God, when the submachine gun just goes off and then the dude crashes his car. What did the dude crashes his car when he's being followed by the beetle?
Yeah.
Blue beetle. And then he drops the joint and then he crashes into a dumpster. Oh man, it's so funny. And the music in this is great. It's a great soundtrack. T-Bone Burnett actually produced the soundtrack and picked all the songs. And they obviously famously collaborated together in Crazy Heart, and he helped produce the music that Jeff Bridges made for that movie. So they've actually been long friends for a while. So that's a great collaboration relationship those two guys have. T-Bone always brings a lot to the movies he works on.
Yeah. The movie does get a little sad when Donnie dies. I feel so sad for Donnie because he's just an innocent guy.
But it's so funny, like, when they're at the mortuary.
It's our most modest option.
This is our most modestly priced urn. He's like, it's $180.
Is there anything else you have?
Is there a Ralph's nearby?
But the scene is great when the nihilists come to get money from him because they think there was actually money involved, but then they're telling him, there was never any money. Well, we still want the money, asshole.
We kick their ass.
They light their fire. The car on fire,
but they're standing like in a band pose
with like spandex outfits playing the music.
Oh my God. And I love that scene because the first time I watched this movie, I had the suspicion that Walter was just full of BS about Nam. But then, and I thought he was just like lying about it all. But then when he beat the crap out of these guys, I was like, okay, this guy definitely was in war.
In Nam.
Yeah. That seems really funny. Yeah.
He messes them up, but poor Donnie.
Yeah, poor Donnie.
It's sad whenever I watch him pass. But yeah, I love Big Lebowski. Got anything else?
I'm good. I got trivia.
All right, let's do some fun facts and trivia for the
Fargo
Big Lebowski
first.
Fargo.
Yeah, let's do Fargo first. The actors in Fargo used a book called How to Talk Minnesotan to help with their accents. In the movie Fargo, when Carl calls Jerry on the phone for the deal to be finished, he tells him, 30 minutes and we'll wrap this thing up, Jerry. From that moment on, the film's running time is exactly 30 minutes until it ends.
Blood has been spilled, Jerry!
Greer Grimson, Pierce Stormare's character, has 18 lines of dialogue in the entire movie and never actually says more than a complete sentence at one time. By comparison, Carl, Steve Buscemi's character, has over 150 lines of dialogue.
Approaching Brainerd from the south, which is the town that Marge is sheriff of, you see a statue of Paul Bunyan with a sign reading, Welcome to Brainerd. In reality, Brainerd has no such statue. Paul Bunyan Amusement Park, located just outside Brainerd, had a huge statue of Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox. The park is now at the old farm between Brainerd and Garrison. Don't you know?
For the Big Lebowski, in an interview with Rolling Stone magazine, John Goodwin stated that the dude referring to the Big Lebowski as a human paraquat was one of the only improvised lines to make it into the final film. Virtually every other line, including every man and dude, was scripted by the Coens. They never really allow improvisation in their movies. Before filming a scene, Jeff Bridges would always ask the Coen brothers, did the dude burn one over on the way? And if they said he had, Jeff Bridges would rub his knuckles in his eyes before doing a take to make his eyes appear bloodshot.
John Turturro originally thought that his character Jesus was going to have a bigger role in The Big Lebowski. When he read the script, he realized the part was quite small, however. The Coen brothers let him eventually come up with a lot of his own ideas for the character of Jesus, like shining the bowling ball and the scene where he dances backwards in slow motion, which he says was inspired by Muhammad Ali.
In the clean television version of the film, the famous line by Walter, this is what happens when you F a stranger in the ass, was changed to, this is what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps. It's frequently cited as one of the most creative edits ever made for a film to be aired on television.
All right, that wraps our episode on Fargo. and The Big Lebowski. We really hope you enjoyed this one as much as we did. We love the Coen brothers. We love talking about these films. Let us know what your favorite Coen brother films are in the comment section of the YouTube video, on Instagram, wherever. Thanks so much for tuning in around the world. Become a patron today at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast.
The dude abides.
Raiders of the Lost Podcast is a Mirror Image production. Sound mixing done by Jacob Kosler. Opening music by Chase Jackson.